Hello, it's your boy Mobley, and welcome to the first episode of It's Just History, where we will be exploring American history through an unbiased lens, at which point I will introduce my bias into the people, places, events, and time periods in which I think deserve a bit more of our attention. I have always maintained that American history, as it is taught in school, is like a C+ average student's creative writing assignment. Take something from its factual state and introduce all of this bias and reorientate the narrative to be not only full of half-truths, but also to destroy context and paint everyday people living their lives as the villain. To start, I want to give background to how I compiled this information. For the purposes of wanting this segment of the series in particular to serve as a grounding resource for people to have a straightforward digest of American history, I wanted to make sure the access was more or less unrestricted. I grew up in the suburbs and had what I have come to realize was an above average education compared to the rest of the country. How did I come to that conclusion? I performed my secondary and postgraduate education in New York and have since lived here, where I have met more people from around the world than I ever thought possible. And just as widespread as the people's origins, so was a lot of stupidity and ignorance. For that reason, the information was compiled in a 5-step process. First, BBC has a summary of what they consider key events in American history that begins in 1565, which is where this series and my research began. I then took that overview and plugged the date into history.com, which gave a more detailed summary of the high-level important events that correspond to that year in American history. Once that was done, I then went through the entire summary file and looked for events, people, locations, groups, etc. that stood out and made a note to follow up on those items. Then I would take to Google to look up about 2 to 5 sources depending on exactly what I was looking up, cross-reference the information, and pick the summary that had the least amount of emotive bias and most detail to copy back into my master document, then make sure I include a citation with the link so I can reference when constructing the script. The final part of the process is constructing the script right now. For this part of the series, everything will be scripted, as that will serve as my principal research of information and the best unbiased summary I can provide. Later on, in the latter segments of this series, I will be giving my opinion on things, and boy do I have them. But for this initial look at history, we're talking facts, and I will do my personal best to keep it both brief and interesting, as you will be sitting here listening to what I even consider to be both the worst and most important subject in school. It should also be noted that the format of this script is largely information presentation, followed by background, and then back to the main story. My master documentation and scripts will be available for download at the end of this project, and I have time to really go through and clean it up for public consumption. This started out as a means for me to further educate myself so I could have conversations about our present and future by giving relevant history and context. As I started having more conversations with more people presenting my findings, it became more and more apparent that this information was lost on many of us. As such, I am grateful to anyone who sits through these because they're going to be long, but to be able to have more educated conversations allows us to reach better conclusions, because you can't argue and be wrong at the same time. Speak with intelligence, take silence to your ignorance. An additional note is that now America as we know it was more commonly referred to as the New World by those during this particular time period that we're looking at, and will often be how I refer to it when recounting these events. I will use the terms the New World and America quite interchangeably, and I will be using the term Native American in all cases of reference to the tribal groups throughout the series. Now that all that housekeeping is done, we can finally jump into the series starting in 1564. Yes. Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, but that part of history, as creatively entitled as they've been with it, is both relatively accurate and mundane to repeat. Subsequent to this Italian man sailing to America on behalf of Spain, thinking it was India, the different countries of Europe made their own exploration attempts and manners of settlement in this land, at which point they had contact with Native Americans and usually killed many with their spread of disease, if not war. Good enough! This is Blood in the River, and I hope you enjoy. In 1564, the French Protestants, or Huguenots, if you will, settled on the banks of May along the Florida coast. Naturally, the French weren't exactly the first to inhabit this land that they had settled in. Before them, there was the Tamaqua tribe, which sadly is no longer in existence according to the National Park Service, an operating organization under the U.S. Department of the Interior, as they had been completely wiped out by the 1800s. More specifically, the mid-1700s, as interaction with the French Huguenots beginning in 1534, where it is said the two parties had the first true Thanksgiving, exposed the Tamaqua to countless diseases with which they had no immunity, and subsequent warfare with English colonists and native allies led to the complete extinction of the tribe. The Tamaqua lived in present-day southern Georgia and northern Florida, and despite not being united politically, or would be expressed as a singular people, all spoke dialects of the same language. When European settlers first arrived in the 1500s, the Tamaqua are said to have occupied over 19,000 square miles of land and be 20,000 strong. For reference, the state of West Virginia is 24,000 square miles and sits as the 41st largest out of 50 states. An entire people spread out over that amount of land is no longer in existence, and there is not a single living member from the tribe able to give us the word-of-mouth version of their history. The history lies with the Tamaquean Ecological and Historic Preserve. When the French arrived in 1534, they were led by René Guillon de Londonderry. And if you're wondering why he's special, it's because he loses battles and allegedly encountered hermaphrodites. Seriously, there's not much out there about him. On the other hand, we have Pedro Menendez de Avilés. He is a Spanish seaman from a gentry family that had 19 brothers and sisters and ran away at the age of 14 to begin his sea life. Pedro is significant here because King Philip II of Spain was unappreciative of Spanish authority being challenged in the New World and sent Pedro to Florida to get rid of the French heretics and establish a Spanish colony. He did just that. The Spanish captured the French Huguenot settlement of Fort Caroline, which would be near present-day Jacksonville, and forced the French to reconsider their colonial efforts, which led them to the north in what is now Quebec and Nova Scotia, in Canada. These efforts were led by Landière and about 40 of his originally estimated 200 men that escaped, as the rest were slaughtered in warfare or allegedly slain and hung by Pedro's heretics. In addition to completing his task of driving out the French, Pedro is also notable for finding San Augustine, which became Saint Augustine, the oldest city in North America. In the 1580s, a guy named Sir Walter Raleigh attempted to plant an English colony referred to as the Lost Colony in present-day North Carolina. Given its namesake, you can imagine how unsuccessful it was, which prolonged any English attempt by the crown until the 1600s. In 1606, the Virginia Company, a joint stock company of wealthy shareholders, had an aim of bringing profit and establishing an English colony in the New World as they had received a charter from King James I. Charter is really just a fancy contract that lays out the liberties and rules of operation that a colony was to observe under their ruler's jurisdiction. Random fun fact. Even though this charter was granted after the failed Lost Colony of Roanoke, the English did this mainly because Spain was establishing the most colonies in the New World. Furthermore, Virginia was the English name for the entire East Coast north of Florida, named after Elizabeth I, the Virgin Queen. In 1607, this group arrived with little less than 150 men and boys in Jamestown Island, which is where they built their fort. Now, Jamestown had many issues. The early colonists were sent there to make a profit for the Virginia Company, but also had to deal with trying to survive in the New World. The only reason they even picked this particular area was because it was easily defensible against possible Spanish attacks, the water was deep enough that they could tie their ships, and there was no native population inhabiting that site. However, the settlement was on a native hunting ground. While they were able to create industries around glass manufacturing, pitch and tar production, and beer and wine making, being alive to do any of this came first and foremost. They erected a three-sided fort on the banks of the James River, where it became more than clear that they were employees. If you're wondering what Jamestown looked like, imagine a triangular wooden fort built around a storehouse for weapons and other supplies, a church, and some shanty houses. The parameters surrounding their employment was as follows. 1. The laborers followed the rules of those sent to rule them, and in exchange received arms, clothes, and food. 2. Upon 7 years of completed labor, they would receive land of their own. 3. For the gentlemen, or the rulers here, they were to provide their own armor and weapons. As compensation, they received land, dividends, or additional shares of stock. The colonists were initially governed by a president and a 7-member council, all appointed by the king. And this is where we get to the many problems that Jamestown faced. Everyone is not really made to be a leader. The first two leaders managed with varying degrees of success against sickness, Native American assaults, poor food and water supplies, and class strife. Things didn't take a turn until Captain John Smith took over as president. Now, before I get into the background of this time period in the Native American-English relations, I somehow find it necessary to mention that Disney has sold you a lie on the relationship between John Smith and Pocahontas, as well as the love or peace that was fostered from that relationship. Remember what I said about American history as a below average student's creative writing assignment? This is probably the epitome. So John Smith became the third president of Virginia in 1608, but who was he if not Pocahontas' lover? John Smith before president was just a mercenary turned sea captain. No, really, his backstory is that simple. Now, as president, he was an effective leader. Remember all those problems of survival I mentioned, from the sickness to Native American assaults? Well, John was the one who was able to foster peace between the settlement and the native Algonquian chief, Powhatan, Pocahontas' father. Algonquian refers to all tribes that speak an Algonquian language. This consists of the Powhatan Native Americans in Jamestown and the Pequots and Narragansetts that lived in New England, encountering the Pilgrims and Puritans. As you will see, Powhatan refers to both the people and the chief of same name. Moving forward, the Powhatan weren't always friendly with the English settlers. As a matter of fact, Powhatan organized the local tribes under him like an empire, and for the first 2 years that the settlers were there, organized many attacks, adding to the stresses of the settlers dealing with hunger, typhoid, and dysentery. Surprisingly, Chief Powhatan was more or less benevolent, and if it was not for his gifts of food to the settlement, it would have likely turned into another lost colony. Despite the lack of absolute peace under John Smith's leadership, the two groups were able to reach a trade agreement in which the Native Americans traded corn for beads, metal tools, and an assortment of objects such as weaponry with the English. This kept the English settlement afloat for about a year, until John Smith returned to England in late 1609, at which point the colony suffered through the Starving Time. The Starving Time was the winter of 1609 to 1610, led under George Percy, when food shortages and a siege by Powhatan Native American warriors killed 2 of every 3 colonists at James Fort. There was an order by Chief Powhatan that any colonists and livestock found outside the fort were to be attacked. Inside the fort, the famine killed more than 100 settlers and is also said to have led a man to practice cannibalism, eating his wife. In spring of 1610, Lord De La Warr arrived with 150 new settlers, a cache of supplies, and was to be the governor of the colony. Until he got sick and returned home. After him, there were Sir Thomas Gates and Sir Thomas Dale, who were a bit overbearing. They issued a system of new laws and strictly controlled the interaction between settlers and the Powhatan. This destroyed a lot of the peace as they launched raids against Powhatan tribes, killing residents and burning houses and crops as they expanded their fort and settlement along the James River. Given that the settlers had learned how to harvest corn successfully and insulate their homes against weather via tree barks, thanks to the Algonquian, by 1611, they were able to expand Jamestown into a new town east of their original settlement. Did I ever mention the first profitable export to come out of Virginia was tobacco? This is less important from the perspective that they were finally making money back on their investment, and more important because John Rolfe was a tobacco planter. Who's John Rolfe? the white man who actually married Pocahontas and had her convert to Christianity, as well as the relationship that allowed a period of peace to foster between the Powhatan and English from about 1614 to 1618. Now we get to talk about Pocahontas. For starters, the Disney rendition is running wild with the narrative that, according to John Smith, Pocahontas rescued him from death as a young girl in 1607, as he was her father's, Chief Powhatan's, captive. By my research, she was about 11 or 12 when this would have occurred, and was not of adulthood slash marriageable age until 14, had about 2 to 3 years to go before a love affair was on the table. At this point, I think I should mention that the most comprehensive resource I was able to find for this comes from National Park Services under the U.S. Department of the Interiors, as they give both a written and oral retelling, which I would encourage everyone to go read for themselves. Link will be in the descriptions. But I mention this because there is both a written and oral recount of her life, which have contradictions both between them and in our understanding of Algonquian life. Furthermore, there is really no knowledge of her early years, as the circumstances surrounding her mother fall to nothing more than speculation based on scant recount reconciled with an understanding of common practices at the time. Back to the rescue mission by an 11-year-old. This is probably the first instance where the oral history makes more sense than the written recount. According to Smith, he was captured by Pocahontas' brother, brought to the town, and his head was laid between two boulders before he was to be executed by a club, wherein Pocahontas runs in laying her head on top of his, and this stopped the ceremony. Then Disney wrote the movie, and you know the rest. Ignoring the lies and fables, this is actually one of the most denounced theories of what happened. Even aligning with all that I've previously described about the conflict of peace resolution between Smith and Chief Powhatan alone, the oral history, which makes a lot more sense and is to be believed more widely, and before someone says it, having common sense and logic does not make me biased against fables, says that Smith was captured by Chief Powhatan's brother and paraded around the tribes as a means of displaying that he, and by proxy the English, were no different than they were. The parade through the village and display of the white Englishman was more akin to a ceremony by which he was welcomed and well regarded. This falls in line with the history that we do know to be true, as the peace brokering occurred and the Powhatan provided the English with better resources as well as locations to survive. The Powhatan had a philosophy that there was more to be gained through peaceful and respectful means than through war and force. A message. But in another account, that doesn't really make sense. Pocahontas rushed through the dead of the night to warn Smith that her father intended to kill him while he was under the capture of her uncle, which begs the question, how did the princess, because in all material respects, she was the daughter to the chief, at which point she was extremely well protected and heavily supervised for her own safety, get past Smith's guards? Not to mention that his welcoming would have been considered a religious ritual, which children were not allowed to attend. Remember, she was about 11 or 12 at this time, still a child. Also, because I didn't mention this before, given that Pocahontas' mother is presumed, by literally every account, dead, this name is more of endearment from her father, as her given name is Motuaka. She does not fully assumed the name of Pocahontas until her coming of age ceremony at 14. So some time has passed since John Smith was even in Virginia. Before jumping into her relationship with John Rolfe, we should note that she was married before him. She married a man with a background that I can't verify named Kokuam, and the reason that it is important to denote that I can't verify what his role in society was is because it is a given that he was not of high status, presenting a relationship of love rather than transaction. In Powhatan society, women were free to choose their men despite position. Now we're back to some misalignment in the story. Not anything principal, however. By some manner, Pocahontas is kidnapped. How is the not so clear part, so we'll omit that as it doesn't actually drive the story. I would, however, encourage you to go read both accounts of what may or may not have happened during that time, as it is an interesting display of tactics and motives, which would lead me to some heavy bias and commentary, so moving along. During her capture, she learned of English life and at some point in her religious instruction met John Rolfe, who introduced tobacco to Virginia and was also a widower. In 1614, Pocahontas was converted to Christianity by someone's direction, possibly her own, married John Rolfe in Jamestown, which had transaction benefits of the Powhatan people being presented well and protected, as well as Rolfe having leverage for the Kierkros, or priests, with his tobacco crops. Oh, and she changed her name to Rebecca. This relationship fostered a three-year period of peace, which quickly died. In 1617, Pocahontas dies as they're headed back to Virginia from England, and in the following year, her father, Chipowitan, also dies. She was about 21. And that is the much more interesting and historically accurate recount of Pocahontas. Again, links will be in the description so you can read through it yourself. If we recall, this peace that existed was really only based on her capture and subsequent marriage to John Rolfe, as her and the village lives were the bargaining chip for the English to keep turning a profit. So as you can imagine, both deaths didn't leave much in the way of peace. As the colonists had an insatiable need for land in their quick expansion, as well as the many diseases they brought with them which decimated Native American populations. The Algonquians under Opechancanough, Powhatan's successor, became more and more angry leading up to an assault in March 1622. This was on the heel of settlers pressing inland for more land to cultivate for tobacco, and land to about 350 settlers, a quarter of its population being slaughtered. As the settlement had underwent a vast expansion by this point, the attack really destroyed the Jamestown outpost, but the town itself was able to mount a defense with advance warning. Backing up for a second, in 1619, the colony established a general assembly with members elected by Virginia's male landowners. This was also the same year that about 50 African men, women, and children arrived in the English settlement from a Portuguese slave ship that was brought to Jamestown, where the colonists worked as indentured servants, probably picking tobacco. The majority of Europeans who came to the Americas were not free settlers or elite landholders. They were indentured servants. In exchange for the cost of ship passage across the Atlantic, men and women from throughout Western Europe came to the Americas to work in a range of labor roles, from skilled trades to plantation agriculture. To pay for the cost of their travel, indentured servants worked for several years for a contract holder who did not pay wages, but did provide housing, food, and clothing. Similar to enslaved Native Americans and Africans, indentured servants could have their contracts sold at market to different bidders, could be physically punished, and in some contexts, servants were not allowed to marry or have children without the permission of their contract holder. However, indentured servants ultimately attained their freedom once they completed their contract, while enslaved people were permanently denied their freedom unless they could obtain the means to purchase themselves or successfully escape. In addition, in the 17th century, various European colonies established laws ensuring that the offspring of enslaved women inherited their legal status from their mother, even if their father was free. I've carved out an entire episode dedicated to the history of slavery and police in America, which will be presented in its own episode probably at the end of the series. I just wanted to take this time to give a bit of background on indentured servants as it is mentioned in this time period. Back to the onslaught. Now we're back to Jamestown having problems. In 1624, King James I dissolved the Virginia Company and made Virginia into an official crown colony, which means a governor acting on behalf of the monarch. And Jamestown was the capital. This area continued to grow, and in 1644, Opechancanough launched another great rebellion, which was no match for the now stronger colony. This attack really only affected the outlying plantations, as in 1634, a wall built on the peninsula which kept the Native Americans at bay for a decade. While they were able to kill more people than the 1622 uprising, the large growth of the settlement left it with a minimal effect, and when the English retaliated, they were able to destroy many of the Native American-controlled resources, as well as capture and kill Opechancanough. In 1646, his successor, Nakatawans, was forced to sign a peace treaty that ceded most of the Powhatan's land and forced them to pay an annual tribute to the colonial governor. While we're still in Virginia, there's another popular rebellion we can look at before jumping back in time and looking north to Massachusetts. I'm talking about Bacon, Nathaniel Bacon, and his popular 1676 uprising. Let's back up for a second, actually. By this point in history, Virginia is under the direction of Governor William Berkeley. There had been a lot of unrest among colonists due to the declining tobacco prices offset with higher taxes. In 1675, the Doag Native Americans raided one of the plantations near the Potomac River as a result of a dispute over non-payment of some items that Thomas Matthews, owner of said plantation, had apparently obtained from the tribe. While the colonists launched a retaliatory attack, they attacked the Susquehannocks, completely different tribe, which led to large-scale Native American raids. What's unique in this situation is that Governor Berkeley actually launched an investigation into the matter and continuously made the efforts for peace and asked for restraint on behalf of the colonists. His peace treaty meetings, however, did not go over well. Along with a few Doag members killed at the raid of Matthews Plantation, his meetings led to the murder of several tribal chiefs. In essence, the colonists were really just looking for a scapegoat to offset the fact that they were no longer doing as well due to growing commercial competition from Maryland and the Carolinas, an increasingly restricted English market, and the rising prices from English manufactured goods. Insert Nathaniel Bacon, Berkeley's cousin, by the way, who disregarded the governor's direct orders by seizing some friendly Appomattox Native Americans for allegedly stealing corn. Berkeley reprimanded him, which caused the disgruntled Virginians to wonder which man had taken the right action. In 1676, Bacon issued his Declaration of the People, which stated that Berkeley was corrupt, played favorites, and protected the Native Americans for his own selfish purposes. This was all it took to start the first rebellion in the American colonies. Did I mention Bacon had a rallying of people with him? An entire volunteer army. To the point that they were able to mount a siege that drove Governor Berkeley from the capital and set Jamestown on fire. The following month, Bacon died of dysentery. The resistance tried to persist, but between armed merchant ships from London and the forces sent by King Charles II, the resistance quickly fell. Done with Jamestown, on to Plymouth Rock. So there is a common thread about the people who came to the New World, and that is generally that they were sent on behalf of an investor group. For the Pilgrims of the Mayflower, there was the London Adventurers, or Merchant Adventurers as they were known in England, whose focus was profit from fur trade, fishing, and any other method the Pilgrims could derive. As an aside, the name Pilgrim wasn't assigned to this group until the early 19th century by the orator Daniel Webster at a bicentennial celebration of Plymouth's founding, where he mentioned Pilgrim Fathers, and then the term just stuck. The Pilgrims were originally supposed to arrive between two ships, the Mayflower and the Speedwell, the latter never making the trip as it was much too smaller and deemed unseaworthy and had to return to port twice. The Mayflower crew was comprised of 102 passengers, 35 of which belonged to the English Separationist Church. In 1910, English persecution led a group of Separationists to flee to Holland in search of religious freedom. However, many were dissatisfied with economic opportunities in the Netherlands, and under the direction of William Bradford, they decided to emigrate to Virginia, Jamestown to be specific. The main differences you'll find in the English Separationist Church beliefs is the idea that Christian believers would seek out other Christians and form their own churches based on faith and not organized gatherings controlled by the state or containing the hierarchies, such as those common to the Catholic Church. Additionally, they strictly observed the Sabbath, not performing any labor on Sunday. The rest of the passengers were entrepreneurs, some of which belonged to the Church of England, looking for a new life and business in the New World. As you can imagine, there was a conflict of interest among the passengers. In 1620, the Mayflower set sail from Plymouth, England, with a British Crown authorization to settle in Virginia, whose borders stretched to what is now New York. During their voyage, they dealt with harsh seas that almost led to a shipwreck and caused a group of passengers to suggest they ignore their patent with the Virginia company and settle elsewhere. Between the navigation errors and the sea troubles, the Mayflower ended up in what is now Provincetown, Massachusetts, far off the course of their original destination. Given that they did not have permission to settle in this land, they formed the Mayflower Compact, which was a temporary adaptation of a Puritan church covenant and only served to bind the signatories into a civil body politic. They still had to await a new permission to settle in New England, which came in the form of the Pierce Patent of 1621. As is becoming a typical theme, half of the colonists died in the first year of settlement due to disease. In 1621, conditions improved for the colonists and they invited neighboring Native Americans to Plymouth to celebrate the harvest season, which allowed them to secure treaties with the local Native American tribes, grow the economy, and attract more colonists. Which Native American tribe did the pilgrims encounter? The Wampanoag tribe, led by Massasoit, who voiced the pilgrims as possible allies against their enemies, the Narragansetts. The specifics of the treaty can be summarized as, "Do no harm to us, and we shall do no harm to you. Violators are to be submitted to the violated for appropriate repercussions." During the time of most colonizers coming to the New World, there was also an agenda to convert the natives to Christianity, much akin to what they did with Pocahontas. In this particular instance, the Wampanoag tribe and the pilgrims had a flourishing and peaceful relationship for four decades, but Massasoit protected his people's spiritual traditions and prevented their conversion to Christianity. Remember when I said that Plymouth was comprised of two groups that didn't see eye to eye religious-wise? Well, by the 1640s, Plymouth's population was around 3,000 people, but was still smaller than the Massachusetts Bay Colony settled by the Puritans in 1629. I want to take some time to digress about Puritan life, less because of significance to the time period, but more because of our understanding of them as a whole is widely skewed. I don't know about you, but when I hear the term Puritan, I immediately think of women as objects, an oppressive religion, and sex and alcohol as the ultimate taboo. Maybe that's not how the Puritans actually lived. Maybe a bit of witch burning. However, that's not how the Puritans actually lived. Our common understanding of them is just exaggerations of some of their principles. For instance, the Puritans weren't anti-sex, they were anti-adultery. They, like most religions, placed a high value on the marital tie, so fornication, sodomy, and anything of the kind outside of that was punishable by fines or whippings. Furthermore, they weren't a society that abstained from alcohol, but rather objected drunkenness. Not a bad principle for everyone to adopt. On the merits of art, while it is accurate to say that they were not a fan of visual creations, they did have a high appreciation for poetry. The black and white garb we typically associate with them? Wrong too. Much to the patriotism today, they enjoyed the colors red and blue. And this one came as a shocker to me during my research, but they were committed to the separation of church and state. An ideal present in America today that has, over recent years, become less separated. For Puritans, there was no system of church courts and ministers could hold public office. But they did hold annual elections where all free men, originally restricted to church members, had the right to vote and hold office. I would be wrong to say that Puritans didn't have an oppressive, repressed society, but that was more dictated by their actions than their beliefs. They were a very actions speak louder than words people, and as such, only provable change would forgive sin. They also believed in predestination, which just meant that God had already chosen who was favored and who was not, who was going to heaven and who was going to hell. So all their work was to honor God, which would lead to prosperous reward. If you're wondering where the repressed nature comes into play, it's more than likely from the thought that the devil was behind every evil deed and any act, any deviation, led you into the clutches of the devil and thus secured you in hell. This led to how they continued to educate their children, having them read the Bible but banning drama and erotic poetry on the principle that it led to immorality, and religious music because it created a dreamy state that interrupted the ability to listen to God. This was, in its own right, rewarding for society as a whole as they had less idle time to fill with trivial pleasures. The Puritans had free schooling for all children, formed the first formal school in 1635, which led to the first American college, Harvard, to be established in 1639. They were the first to write books for children, and of the Americans who were admitted into the Scientific Royal Society of London, the vast majority were New England Puritans. A lot with some repeating themes and a few surprises along the way. In this final segment of the first episode, we'll be jumping to 1763. This part more accurately begins in 1689 and is just the culmination of a lot of wars. There were three wars that we won't be talking about in depth that all had to do with land domination. King William's War from 1689 to 1697, Queen Anne's War from 1702 to 1713, and King George's War from 1744 to 1748. All three wars and the ones I'm about to discuss were all about land, so keep that in mind as we progress. There are two wars that overlap with the rebellion at the end. The beginning being the French and Native American War, where France and Great Britain fought from 1754 to 1763, 9 whole years to determine control of the colonial territory of North America. This war began around the Upper Ohio River Valley, where there was discrepancy of whether it was part of the British or French Empire. That leads to the bigger problem of which national culture was to dominate North America. In this instance, the French were in the lead with exploration, trade, and Native American alliances. The bulk of this battle, however, is under the aptly named Seven Years' War from 1756 to 1763. The French Native American War is more focused on the control of North America, whereas the Seven Years' War is the European battle following the War of the Austrian Succession in an attempt for Austria to win back the province of Silesia. If you're interested in that war, there will be more information on it in my master document, as well as citations to where I pulled that information, and you are more than welcome to research that, but I will be focusing on North America. And in America, France was defeated, which led to two important treaties being signed for different reasons. In 1763, at the conclusion of both wars, there was the Treaty of Paris. This renounced all of mainland North America east of the Mississippi River, excluding New Orleans and environs, the West Native American islands of Grenada, St. Vincent, Dominica, and Tobago, and all French conquests made since 1749 in India or in the East Indies. Also, in America, there was the Proclamation of 1763, in which a boundary was created to check the encroachment of European settlers on Native American lands. This line was to separate the British colonies on the Atlantic coast from Native American lands west of the Appalachian Mountains. The Proclamation of 1763 was nothing more than an appeasement, however, and could not heal the great pain and grievances felt by the Native Americans. In 1763, there came Pontiac's Rebellion, where Pontiac, an Ottawa chief, led a revolt including the Ojibwas, Pottawatomies, Huron, Miami, Wies, Kickapoo, Maskoutin, Piankashua, Delaware, Shawnee, Wyandot, Seneca, and Seneca Cayuga tribes. In May of 1763, they destroyed Fort Detroit and went on to kill or capture upwards of 600 people. The rebellion was short-lived in essence, ending in 1764, but Pontiac did not officially surrender until 1766. The proclamation, while creating an imaginary barrier for non-natives, was imaginary, and non-natives continued to encroach and settle on the land specifically outlined for the Native Americans. Despite the West being separated for the Native Americans, colonists would defy the proclamation to find good farmland, and for some, merely because they resented royal restrictions on trade and migration. This resentment for the royal crown was held by 13 of Great Britain's North American colonies and led to the American Revolution, or Revolutionary War, from 1775 to 1783. This came on the heels of British attempts to assert great control over colonial affairs after having a long-standing policy of salutary neglect, which is just policy of the British government from the early to mid 18th century regarding its North American colonies, under which trade regulations for the colonies were laxly enforced and imperial supervision of internal colonial affairs was loose as long as the colonies remained loyal to the British government and contributed to the economic profitability of Britain. This began as a civil war within the British Empire until 1778, when it became an international war as the French, later followed by the Spanish in 1779, joined the colonies against Britain. And I'll leave it there, because in episode 2, we'll start in 1774 and go over the American Revolution properly. Today was a lot, and I want to thank those of you who stayed and were able to keep track with all the time jumping. Join me in episode 2, where we'll look at the American Revolution and a few events subsequent to the Declaration of Independence. But I'm curious, how much of that information did you know already? Was it this clear when you were studying history in grade school? Put your responses down in the comments below, as well as any questions for specific information that you felt I didn't cover in this episode and would like clarity or direction on, where to dig a bit deeper. I can also be reached at syncret.com. That's synkret@gmail.com for any questions or comments. And remember, it's not personal, it's just history. Now, have a good day and go have more educated conversations. Mobley out.